But first today, the six essential skills of extraordinary entrepreneurs. Author Amy Wilkinson went to the source, actually to 200 of them, and interviewed the founders of eBay, Under Armour, Chipotle, LinkedIn, Tesla Motors, and others for her new book, The Creator's Code, The Six Essential Skills of Extraordinary Entrepreneurs. Creators, Wilkinson discovered, are not born, but made. They work at it and share fundamental skills that can be learned, practiced, and passed on. Amy Wilkinson is a strategic advisor, entrepreneur, and lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She joins us this morning from NPR Studios in New York. And Amy, thank you for taking some time.
Oh, thank you, Steve. It's a delight to be on your program.
Great, great. Well, what struck me as interesting about these six essential skills that you came up with is the idea that, you know, expertise in, say, you know, manufacturing or retail or the field that you want to bring out a product in is not one of the six skills. Why is that?
You know, it is a counterintuitive finding in some ways. I believe it's because the world is changing so incredibly quickly that entrepreneurs or creators of new ideas, they really have to get in and experiment. They fail wisely. That's one of the six skills.
Yeah.
They continue to persevere. But old ways of working, the assembly line approaches or having 10 years of experience in a field, that's not what I found.
That's so interesting to me. And you begin your book with a man named Kevin Plank, who had no special expertise in fabrics before he became the head guy at Under Armour. Why did he begin developing these products? I mean, what's his story?
So Kevin is a fabulous story. He's the founder of Under Armour.
Yeah.
He was a walk-on fullback to the University of Maryland, kicked out of Georgetown Prep in high school, bounced into a military academy, and then really wanted to play Division I football, but he wasn't that great of an athlete. He wasn't recruited, so he walked on, and then he became known as Maryland's sweatiest player because he was just always working harder than everyone else.
What a great honor that was for Kevin Plank.
Yeah, right. Famous for being the sweaty guy. But he found it a problem. He weighed the cotton T-shirt under his uniform, found that it was 3 pounds of additional weight. He couldn't
afford... When it was wet from his working out.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So he went to a local fabric store in College Park, Maryland, walked in, explained the somewhat comical problem, learned that synthetic fabrics would wick away moisture. So he took a stretchy bolt of fabric to a local tailor and with $450 made 7 different prototypes of an undershirt to wear under a football uniform and went back to the locker room and had all of his friends, other players, try the various prototypes. He went locker room to locker room then in the Atlantic Coast Conference at the time and really started peddling this new synthetic fabric shirt. And Under Armour today is a $2 billion global sports brand. It's amazing.
So what made him so successful? What was the key behind Kevin Plank having the foresight to do what he did when it came to his T-shirt underneath his shoulder pads?
Well, one of the things, and it's the first skill of the six skills, is to find a gap. And one way to find a gap, as he did, is to solve your own problem. So he really solved his own problem, right? He was an athlete that was looking for an edge. He thought if he could have a certain kind of sports equipment, it might help him on the field. Then it expanded to helping a lot of other athletes. And that's one of the keys, is looking for things that other people aren't addressing, looking for a friction point, solving a problem, finding a gap or an opportunity. That's the very first thing that Kevin did. But it's a really critical one, and sometimes they're unexpected. The little-known secret of Under Armour, which Kevin loves to say in a joking way, is it's the same fabric as women's lingerie.
Yes.
It's the same fabric as used by Victoria's Secret or others. So, I mean, you wouldn't find a football player normally deciding that that's the solution, big, tough guy problem. But at any rate, you know, he found a gap, and that's one of the real – starting points for creating and scaling ideas.
We're talking with Amy Wilkinson about her new book, The Creator's Code, The Six Essential Skills of Extraordinary Entrepreneurs. So Kevin Plank's initial vision then, Amy, wasn't to become a titan of industry per se. It was to get a product that would benefit somebody like himself.
That's right. So, you know, it came out of a need. And a lot of great products really do come out of a need. And then, of course, you know, he didn't go on to play professional football. Some of the people he had played with did. And so he was then contacting them to try to see if his new product would be interesting to other college teams or professional football teams. Then it expanded to lacrosse players and baseball players. And then, interestingly, they found that women were buying size small and they were getting sold out of this small Under Armour shirt. And so one mistake they made along the way was he thought you could just shrink it and pink it. That was the mantra for making things smaller and making them pink and women would like them. And that, in fact, didn't work. They lost. They had to move inventory out that wasn't properly fitted for women and hire a women's team in and design for women's bodies and design products that women would actually use in sports. And so, you know, it's one of these things that started as solving his own problem, but then it's solving a lot of problems for a lot of different athletic people.
Well, let's talk about another guy who solved his own problem. And again, this is early in the book. You tell the story of Joe Gebbia, if I'm saying that right.
Gebbia. Yes.
He had an issue with his rent in his San Francisco apartment, as legions of people do in San Francisco. One day he got a letter from his landlord that said his rent was going up 25%. What did Joe decide to do about it, Amy?
So Joe and his roommate, Brian, they, at the time in 2007, were designers. They're Rhode Island School of Design graduates, and they really couldn't afford their rent. San Francisco is a very expensive place to live. And so with that bad news, which was the rent was going up 25%, they were wondering how they would afford their apartment. They were going to a conference that week, a designers conference in San Francisco, and noticed on the website that the hotels were sold out. And so they looked at each other, Joe and Brian, and said, hey, we've got an air mattress or two in the closet, and we have a living room. What if we basically get other designers to stay on these air mattresses, and we'll charge them a little bit, and we'll make rent? And so that's, in fact, what they did. And it didn't – that business, while today Airbnb is an enormous business, they have 200,000 beds around the world being filled by Airbnb users now. It was not a fast start. So they started with this get other designers to just have air mattresses on the floor of their own apartment. But, you know, it took lots. They were passed on by about 45 different venture capitalists. They raised money on credit cards. And then the wonderful way they raised enough money to stay afloat was around the 2008 presidential campaign and around the conventions, again, a conference idea. They made breakfast cereal. They're designers. They designed cereal boxes, right?
Tell about so the Obama cereal. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was Obama, Hope in Every Bowl, or Cap'n McCain, A Maverick in Every Bite. And they raised $25,000 from designing these cereal boxes with the idea that it was a bed and breakfast. You know, it was an air bed and breakfast model. But that if you also had cereal, then you would be happily staying on someone's couch or sleeping on their air mattress. So that's how they raised enough funding to really get going.
So Joe cracked the creator's code too, you know, along with Kevin Plank. So what is the creator's code, Amy, that you talk about the title of your book here?
So it is six essential skills, and they're informed by these 200 interviews with entrepreneurs who've started and scaled companies over $100 million in annual revenue. There's the data set for getting into the criteria, but the code is really that when you take these six skills together, the magic happens. You can crack the code, and it's an idea that if there's DNA for the body, right, there's a code for entrepreneurship. And these six things, when taken together, really do make anyone's ideas take off.
Does every entrepreneur have to possess all six traits that you describe in the book?
So the research informs that. So we might be naturally good at finding the gap. That's the first skill. Or driving for daylight. That's the second skill. But these unbelievable creators have all six skills. So it really is the idea that they're all learnable and teachable. They can be practiced and passed on. But we need six things to come together that will unlock results.
You know, when you started out on your journey here to interview these 200 leading entrepreneurs, were you looking for common traits, or did you think you'd come up with six, or what were you aiming for as you began all of this?
So that's a great question. I was working in the White House at the time. I was a White House fellow, and I was doing international trade and economics work. And it was such a great privilege to be in that public service role. I was at the time invited to a birthday party, in fact, in New York City, and came to this hip, cool, sort of dark basement place. And I looked around and was awe-inspired because there were the founders of Google and eBay and Gilt Group and a bunch of startups there. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, these people are really, truly changing the world. There's no bureaucracy. There's no red tape. They're creating first-of-their-kind ideas. And if I could just study them, I'm actually trained as a sociologist. So if I could study these people and identify what they had in common, I thought really we could codify, you know, the secret sauce to entrepreneurial success. And then other people could also replicate it. And so I'm also trained as an MBA. And so with that business background, I know that bottom line results matter. And so I thought, gosh, you know, if we could study these people and then pass along what they do and how they do it, other people could improve their results. We could expedite performance and productivity. And it comes from my vantage point very much as, you know, hopefully a public service to the world to put this out there as research-based, informed practices so that all of us can hopefully create and scale our own ideas.
And again, the key here is that other entrepreneurs can learn these traits and adapt them for their own. That's sort of the central guiding point of your mission of your book.
That's right. So it doesn't take a special kind of credential, and it doesn't take $1 million or perfect timing or an MBA, right? It doesn't take sort of traditional ways of getting into business. The people profiled in the book and really the research shows that all of us, that entrepreneurship is very accessible to everyone, and all of us can find ideas and we can create and scale them.
Well, let's walk through the six skills here. In the meantime, let me invite our listeners to chime in here if you have questions about these shared traits or what it takes to become a successful entrepreneur. Amy Wilkinson very well may have the answers for you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Okay, let's start and talk about these skills. And let's just begin with the first one, because you say they have to have, they possess the right stuff. All these entrepreneurs have all these six skills. Number one is find the gap. What does that mean, Amy, to find the gap?
So find the gap means spot an opportunity, spot a gap, see something that others don't see. And I think there are three ways, in fact, that creators are doing that. One of them is as a sunbird. So this is the Australian word for hummingbird. And the idea is you could see something in one place and then fly it over to another place, right? And the Starbucks founder, Howard Schultz, is a great example. So he observed coffee culture in Italy and then flew it back to Seattle and had to do a little twist on it. He originally had bow tie clad waiters and opera music and things that were not Starbucks that we know today, right?
Yeah.
So that's one way of seeing a gap, is actually seeing something and then transporting it. Another would be to spot an opportunity as an architect, literally build something from the ground up. And Elon Musk is a great example with SpaceX.
Which is
Well, so SpaceX is an aerospace company. It's based in Southern California, and it is now resupplying the International Space Station. So SpaceX has taken over contracts from NASA, and they're building rockets and sending supplies back and forth, putting satellites into space. And they're doing it at one-tenth the cost that NASA did. And the way that's possible is to build something, each component part, from the ground up. And so that would be an architect way of, like, seeing a gap. And Elon Musk thought that we just weren't pushing hard enough on space exploration, so he stood up a private company to do that. And then the third way of finding a gap would be as an integrator. And so the Chipotle founder, Steve Ells, is a great example. He's a classically trained chef, and he integrated the idea that you could have cooking with healthier ingredients and right there in an open kitchen, and also have a fast food model. Because previously, fast food was just hamburgers that we would have frozen and warm up. So this became fast casual, the integration of fast food and casual dining. So Chipotle is a $20 billion global brand now, but it really started just with one guy who was trained as a chef who loved burritos. Jeez. And he was looking around at San Francisco at the time, the company's headquartered out of Denver. But, you know, the idea that we could look for an intersection or luxury and SUV, when you put that together, you get an, you know, before we had luxury vehicles or all-terrain vehicles, but we didn't have the luxury SUV, created a whole category.
You know,
so that's another way.
The tricky thing to me when you describe these things, and I'm sure maybe our listeners feel the same way, is you describe these businesses and they all sound like they make so much just common sense. Of course that's going to work. Of course there's a gap in the market. And it sounds so simple when, in fact, I'm sure it's something very, very different from that.
Well, you know, there's academic research. So I've spent 5 years on the research here. So there's the primary interviews, but then there are academic studies as well that inform the framework of this book. And one of the academic studies shows that we all have tacit awareness, right? So we all see things in our lives, in our day-to-day, you know, walking from work to home or whatever, and then we rationalize them away. And the big difference here is that creators, in finding a gap, they jump on it. And if they see something, an anomaly or something that attracts their attention, they don't rationalize it away. There's also research that shows that a five-year-old child asks about 100 questions a day. And as we age, we stop doing that. So by middle age, you know, we might ask 4 or 5 questions a day. And that's one of the things in finding a gap is, you know, keep asking questions and keep, if you see something that doesn't quite make sense, like explore it, ask about it.
I mean, as a rule, do these entrepreneurs have a product and then they look for the gap or look for the gaps and then try to fill it? Amy, which way does it usually go?
I think it goes both ways. So Kevin Plank, who we talked about, you know, he had a problem, the sweaty Maryland football player.
Yeah.
He was just a sweaty guy trying to be a better athlete. So there's a problem that then makes him go out and chase that problem. But in some cases, people are finding a product and then thinking, wow, how come this isn't out there in a different way, right? And so then they can scale it.
Well, your number two on your list of 6 essential skills of extraordinary entrepreneurs is drive for daylight. What does that mean?
So drive for daylight is how creators manage speed like race car drivers. So when you're moving really, really fast, you want to look for the light on the horizon, not the lines on the pavement and not the competitors next to you, because you're just moving too fast to orient in that way. And I actually enrolled in NASCAR driving school to drive a car and try to figure out exactly if this analogy made sense. And really, when you're operating in a super fast way, you do always focus forward. And so drive for daylight, that's the concept. There's a great example of Elizabeth Holmes, who's the founder of Theranos. And this is a lab testing business.
I was going to ask you about her. Yeah. The Stanford University. She started at Stanford, then dropped out.
That's right. So she dropped out of Stanford at age 19. She's been in stealth mode with this company for 10 years, which is a long time to have no one know really what you're doing. She's very much driving for daylight on a long-term vision of detecting disease in time for us to act on it. So if you take a few drops of blood with a little finger stick technology that she's developed, and she signed a big contract now with Walgreens. It will roll across 8,000 Walgreens in the United States. You go in and just take a few drops of blood. With 2 or 3 drops, you can turn around 200 or 300 diagnostic tests. And then the idea is, if we do this, you know, frequently, and it's not painful or costly to us, we might detect cancer before it's a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
We might detect heart disease before you have a heart attack. So it's a very long-term driven business to try to help people, right, and make lives a lot better instead of detecting disease when it's too late.
That's so interesting. Again, we're talking about the six essential skills of extraordinary entrepreneurs. Amy Wilkinson is our guest. She's the author of The Creator's Code, and the subtitle is just what I said it is. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. The third essential skill, Amy, fly the OODA loop. Hello, what's
That's
the
right.
OODA loop? Yeah.
So the OODA loop is, it stands for observe, orient, decide, and act. Huh. And originally, the OODA loop came out of the Air Force. It was how to shoot down an opposing fighter jet faster than the competition. So if you could observe, orient, decide, and act faster, then you could change the dynamics of a fight. And that's the same idea in the business world. PayPal is a fabulous example of this as a company. The original PayPal founders moved through six different ideas, six different business models in 18 months.
Hmm.
I don't know if you remember the Palm Pilot. Did you have a Palm, Steve?
I know what it is. No. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Not me.
So at one point, they were beaming money between Palm Pilots. You know, they thought they would have a virtual wallet or an encrypted technology. I mean, they kept having all these different ideas. But what they did is they observed, for example, on this beaming between Palm Pilots of money, that everyone was using the website, the support site for their technology. And they thought that was so strange. But then they oriented to it really quickly, decided and acted, and PayPal became an online money platform, emailing money, basically, with a website. Then they observed that eBay users, buyers and sellers at the time, were sending checks in the mail, waiting and wondering. But they thought, gosh, you know, people over there were trying to use the PayPal technology. Originally, they thought, that's a distraction.
Yeah.
But then they jumped on it. Again, they observed and they oriented to it. And they basically built PayPal on top of eBay. And eBay eventually bought them. eBay couldn't catch up. They were a much, much larger company. But they didn't observe, orient, decide, and act as fast. And so even though they had more resources and more people and everything else, this tiny little startup prevailed. And then the more interesting thing is that the original 12 people at PayPal went on to start Yelp and YouTube and Slide and Dig and Tesla Motors. They're the first investors behind Facebook.
Wow.
They went basically on to start the entire next wave of the internet. And when you talk to them, they talk very much about this, you know, iterating quickly and changing or looking for a counterintuitive blip of data. That's what the Yelp founder, for example, Jeremy Stoppelman, will talk about. Because it's just moving quickly to decide and act faster than someone else and then continuing to do that.
Hmm. Number four rule is to fail wisely. I mean, number four skill set here, fail wisely. You mean what by that?
So this is different from failing fast and failing forward. I think we've heard about that for a while. This is actually setting a failure ratio. So basically saying, I want to get it wrong a certain percentage of the time, 20%, 10%, 15%. You don't want to fail catastrophically, right? But you want to have some failure and imperfection built in. And that's different than business has been in the past. And a great example here is a company called Opower. There are a couple founders. They were friends in college, Dan and Alex, and they really wanted to start a conservation of energy business. And they did it with experiments. This is one of the ways to fail wisely is to place, if you have $100, place 10 $10 bets, right, instead of one big $100 bet. So in their company, they were started based on an experiment where they put door knockers on the doors of homes in California during the summer heat, saying, please turn off your air conditioning, turn on your fan. You could be a good citizen. And no one did it. That experiment didn't work. So then they put a door knocker on that said, you know, turn off your air conditioning, turn on your fan. You could save the planet and global warming matters. Again, nobody changed their behavior. They did a third experiment that said, please, with the door knocker on the homes, basically saying you could save $55 on your bill, on your energy bill. Again, no one changed their behavior. And then the fourth door knocker said 77% of your neighbors are turning off their air conditioning and turning on their fans. Would you be interested in doing that, too? And that's the social pressure of that experiment is what exactly is the basis for their company. So they continue to do experiments like that. And what they're showing is that when you believe that you might bump into your neighbor and your neighbor is just, you know, being a better conserver of energy than you are, you change your behavior.
That's interesting because we're seeing some of that spill over into politics, which is what I cover for the newspaper here. This notion that, hey, your neighbor voted. Have you voted yet? You know, and people are getting flyers that way. And it's proven to be very successful at motivating people to do something they maybe ordinarily wouldn't have done.
Right. That's exactly the principle behind O-Power, is that there's a lot of positive social pressure in changing behavior.
Okay, your fifth essential trait, network minds. What does that mean?
So network minds is about bringing brain power towards you, right? It's about harnessing cognitive diversity. So we talk a lot about diversity, meaning what we look like on the outside. So race, gender, socioeconomic differences. This research really informs that it matters what goes on inside our minds. And how can you get other brains, other minds, to join you in solving problems in new ways? And a great example is out of GE. The designer of the MRI machine there was in the hospital looking at this beautiful technology that takes wonderful scans. And a 7-year-old little girl was coming down the hallway and going to have an MRI scan and completely melted down, was crying, and it was terrible for her and her parents and the lab techs and everyone else. And Doug Dietz, the designer for GE, felt like he had failed. And so what he did is he got together very unusual minds. He had local daycare providers, museum people who designed for children's museums, children themselves, parents, lab techs, nurses, medical people, all together talking about what this experience could be like to improve the experience for children. And the other thing here is that the sedation rate for kids to get an MRI is 80% typically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's also a medical risk. You know, nobody wants that in order for a child to stay quiet in an MRI. So after this networking of minds and bringing all these people together, GE launched the Adventure Series. And there are now 7 adventures that kids can go on. The machines are designed like a jungle safari or
idea.
A nautical thing,
mm-hmm.
right, or a space odyssey trip. They play music. They have decals. The lab techs are all dressed up in costumes. It feels like they're going to camp. I mean, it's this great experience, and the sedation rate's basically zero now.
Huh, that's really
so interesting. The idea that the technology could be the same, but the problem that they solved there was the experience for a child, and they did it by bringing all these very diverse minds together. To figure out a different way.
Your number 6 trait, your final trait, Amy, is it focuses on generosity. You call it gift small goods.
That's right. So gifting small goods, a small good would be like a small kindness or a small favor.
Mm-hmm.
And in the workplace, that would look like forwarding a resume or critiquing a proposal, writing a few lines of code. And basically what this is in a transparent, reputation-based world where we know the actions of someone else, people who are generous, in fact, are more productive because others want to work with you. Hmm. So this is the basis of LinkedIn. Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn, has this very idea in mind that on LinkedIn, we could open a door for someone, help someone get a job, and that would make everyone more productive. And so the research here is pretty fascinating and pretty different in the last 5 years. I mean, it used to be nice to be a nice guy, right? And now, in fact, nice guys finish first because other people want to work with them and bring information and ideas and talent and everything else to those who are collaborating and those who are gifting small goods.
And just a final point today, Amy, these 6 traits and these 6 skills, they all sort of work together, right?
Yes. So it's when combined,
mm-hmm.
These things, this is the unlocking or cracking the code, right? It's when you bring these 6 things together that the magic happens. And we'll naturally be better at one or another or 3 of the 6, but this is not a checklist. This is not like I only do 2 or only do 3. They're all very practicable and teachable, and we all need to be doing them simultaneously. And that's what really makes ideas take off.
I should point out that Amy Wilkinson will be discussing the fundamental strategies she distilled for the Creator's Code, the 6 Essential Skills of Extraordinary Entrepreneurs, at 6:30 tomorrow evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Admission is free, but you want to RSVP at kclibrary.org. The presentation is co-presented by the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. Amy, what a great conversation. Thank you so much for walking us through those 6 essential skills. It was great to have you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being on your show.
We'll see you tomorrow night, 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Thanks so much.